inshallah, we would be like Imam Ali Salam, following him truly. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Danesh, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Some European leaders are condemning statements by Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich calling for the annexation of the West Bank by the Zionist regime. Is Europe getting tired of Israel, or is it feigning fatigue? The reality is that from the very beginning, Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, has said that Israel should include Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, as well as all of Palestine. And the Europeans gave a rubber stamp to the Zionists. So what does it all mean now? Stay with me as we take a look at all of this on tonight's Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. And Sakina Datu, journalist and writer out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let me start it off with Mick in Glasgow. Mick, do you think Israel has become a liability for Europe?
Well, Israel has been a liability in terms of the relations between the elites, between the governments of Europe and their populations for a very, very, very long time. I mean, over 20 years ago, the EU discovered that the majority of people in every EU country were extremely hostile to Israel and saw Israel as a major threat to world peace. But even then, well before the current genocidal violence, the EU foreign affairs spokesperson, Franco Frattini, at that time, apologized to Israel for the opinions of Europeans, but he promised Israel that those opinions would not be allowed to influence EU policy towards Israel. So we have this situation which is very, very long-term, which has only ever gone in a single direction. Israel has never become less unpopular or become popular. Everything has gone for decades in one direction. Israel has become increasingly unpopular in terms of the great mass of the European countries' populations. But for the governments, of course, who are very, very committed to selling arms, to supporting Israel diplomatically, politically. This is a problem. Now, that problem is now reaching screaming point because a great majority of people in Britain believe that Israel's committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, as measured in a poll recently. The great majority wants a ceasefire immediately, but the Prime Minister, the political so-called opposition, corporate elites, the mainstream media, and you have to say institutions like the Football Federation provide a cover for Israel at every opportunity. So that tension is becoming very, very strong indeed, even stronger than before. Mm-hmm. But yes, to answer your question, it's always been a liability, but something that the elites have managed to navigate for a long time.
Well, Sakina, would you say that the European support for the Israeli regime, especially during this genocide, has totally discredited the whole EU, or how do you see it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, Mick said, I agree with him. I think that in Europe, the tide has really changed. I do believe that there is a difference from before October 7th. So whereas the leaders have always been, in cohort with Israel, for example, in Germany and in France before, and largely in Britain, I think there has been a change since October 7th in the sense that the populations have changed their mindsets a lot. Before, I think, October 7th, the Hasbara was very, very powerful. I think the misinformation that we saw in the media, because of that, the huge swaths of the populations in Europe used to side with Israel because they used to believe in whatever propaganda that the mainstream European media outlets continue to churn out. However, this has changed. So whereas you still see, countries like Germany, like Denmark, like the ruling elite of Britain supporting unconditionally Israel, what happened, for example, just makes it very obvious that the people now have realized all this propaganda. They have watched a live genocide, and they continue to see. I mean, I think what happened in Amsterdam was really a point in case which a lot of people are talking about here in Europe, because they saw these violent mobs come into Europe, and they saw the reality of what they are all about. If they have really, the guts to come in the heart of European cities and create this violence, it is now believable for anyone in Europe to understand what they must be doing in Gaza. Okay. So I do think that the tide has really changed.
Okay. Well, Mick, EU policy chief, EU chief Josep Borrell has condemned Smotrich's statement of annexing the West Bank. Why is this the case? Is this real? Is he because of the difference in opinion between the people and the governments? Does he have to say this? Or your overall assessment of his condemnation?
Well, when I was growing up, we were taught that the British Empire was so big and so beautiful, the sun didn't set on the empire.
Right.
But, the Irish had a slogan that said, that's because God couldn't trust the British in the dark. and I think Mr. Borrell fits into that pattern as well. He's very embarrassed by Smotrich. Smotrich should play the game. He should continue to dispossess Palestinians, but don't say that Israel intends to take over the whole of historic Palestine. Because the EU, in order to keep funneling weapons, sweetheart research deals with Israeli universities and so on, they need the illusion, they need the alibi that says when their populations say, we want action against Israel now, the response is, no, wait till the future. There will be a two-state solution, blah, blah, blah. But it's an alibi for doing nothing now. And along comes Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu, and they blow this out of the water. They say every square meter of Palestine will belong only to Jews. Jewish supremacy will rule, and that's just the end of it. There's no room for a Palestinian state. So Borrell is embarrassed. He wants to continue with the old dishonest game, and Smotrich won't play along. Because in the story of every settler colonial project, the settlers reach a certain stage of strength or confidence, and they think that they can dispense with their imperial protector. America did this with Britain in 1776. The, The Israelis did it with Britain, sorry, the Zionists did it in 1948. But now the more extreme settlers think that they don't need America, they don't need Britain, or they don't need the EU. So they're coming out and speaking very, very honestly. I mean, they're disgusting, but they're very honest about their intentions, which is Palestine without Palestinians. Borrell doesn't like this. He doesn't care how it goes, but he wants to be protected from the reality in terms of his own public opinion, because public opinion will not stand for that.
Right. Well, Sakina, your perspective, the price that Europeans are paying for supporting the Israeli regime.
I think they have paid a huge price, you know, forever, but now it's becoming clear. So very much on the ground, if you think about it, the amount of aid that is, for example, given to Israel, whether in arms or in other means, while the population itself is suffering, the budget has just, you know, recently been announced here, and we are discussing very basic things over here, things like, you know, a 2% taxation difference, talking about, you know, people who are going to not be able to heat their homes, the small businesses going out of business because of a little bit of an increase in the taxation. So the country is really suffering. Europe has suffered, just as I think US has always suffered, and not just in Ukraine. Spending the amount of resources that it is to fuel these wars, and its own population is, you know, not able to even sometimes put one meal. This is a developed country. UK is, for example, the eighth richest country in the world, and yet the population really are talking about basic stuff like, you know, electricity, like being able to afford a meal, being able to stay warm. So I think Europe has definitely suffered. But apart from the economic aspect of it, I think there is a huge suffering in terms of the identity and what Europe stands for. So if before we used to hear how we were the champions of democracy and moral authority around the world, and this Israel has managed to erode this image completely. We are now struggling, for example, in Britain, there's constant discussions on our airwaves about what being British means. So the values that, you know, people were proud of have been eroded by our support for Israel and our support for open genocide. So yes, definitely Europe has suffered, and I think it will continue to suffer, because the imperialist forces are a few, and the masses, who are many, are going to pay the prices for the sins that have been committed by these few.
Okay. Well, Mick, we saw how the Dutch government took the side of the Israeli hooligans over its own people during clashes between Israeli football fans and Dutch fans after the Israelis spewed off racist slogans on the streets of Amsterdam. I mean, why is that the case? Because we were talking about a football game, and of course we know that there are football hooligans everywhere, and it could have been dealt with on a very, very different level, but the Dutch government and other Western governments and their mainstream media, we have seen, have turned it into something total opposite of reality. When people have witnessed what has happened and they have shared the actual videos online.
Oh, very much. In fact, Sky News, which is a major TV station news agency here in Britain, they made a mistake because they published the truth. They produced a video showing the violence of the Maccabi fans and the reaction from the population of Amsterdam. And then they got the memo and they changed. They deleted the early video and they gave what their magnates wanted, an anti-Semitic attack. They used language. I mean, the media now are just going crazy. Personally, I welcome it because it's so crazy that millions of people are beginning to see more clearly the reality of the mainstream media here. To talk about Kristallnacht, to compare people defending themselves against, and I think they're actually more than just hooligans. I think this was the Israeli army out of uniform, not just like normal hooligans. This was a demonstration in support of the genocide and in support of the Israeli military. We saw that because, comically, the Israelis were going to send rescue planes for their hooligans. So it was very tightly connected to the state. And you know, it just gets crazy. people who were demonstrating on the streets of Amsterdam and who continued demonstrating even when they went back to Tel Aviv to say there are no schools in Gaza because there are no children. And they actually jeered and laughed and celebrated the killing of tens of thousands of Palestinian children. This is a provocation beyond human endurance. When a few people decided that this was unacceptable on the streets of their city, and some of the hooligans got a kicking, it was no more than they deserved. But this was a response by a healthy population in Amsterdam to these psychotic genocide, jeerers and laughers and sneerers on the streets of Amsterdam. And yet Biden comes on and talks about an anti-Semitic outrage. Macron is going to a football game in Paris quite soon to show solidarity with Jews. Now, here's a question. Kristallnacht was a pogrom against Jews in Nazi Germany. Shops were smashed to pieces. Jewish life was damaged very badly. Not a single Jewish shop has been damaged in Amsterdam. There's no history, there's no record of anybody asking for police protection. This was directed completely against those who were celebrating genocide and sticking it in the faces of people in Amsterdam. And even the liberal press, when they report it, they talk about, yes, there was a rise in Islamophobia, but there was also a big rise in anti-Semitism. No, there wasn't. Anti-Semitism is now defined as hostility to Israeli genocide and hostility to Israel. This was a healthy response by a healthy population against Zionist thugs who invaded their city and behaved in a way that no city in the world would accept. But I think the mainstream media have been caught out because they did what they were programmed to do, report an anti-Semitic outrage. There was none. There wasn't even a small one. There was nothing whatsoever. There were people who opposed Islamophobia, who opposed Israel as one of the world centres for spreading Islamophobia and sending a squad into Amsterdam to carry that disease even further. So, yeah, the mainstream media has been not just biased and untruthful. They are always biased and untruthful about Israel. But this time they have gone so far that millions of people seeing the videos on social media recognize for the first time.
Well, what about that, Sakina? Do you think that increasingly more people are catching on to this ploy and this use of anti-Semitism because it's not about being against Jews, it's about being against the racist policy of the Zionist regime? Do you think that more people have become aware, just like Mick just said, after millions have watched, for example, on social media, what the reality was on the ground in Amsterdam, that more and more people are waking up to the mainstream media's lies and ploys?
There is no question about that. You only have to go into the comment sections of, mainstream media's stories here in the UK to see how people are really, ordinary people are challenging. It has now actually become fashionable here, to be called anti-Semitic because it's like a badge of honor because the sting that was always attached to being called anti-Semitic or anti-Semite has disappeared. I mean, everybody is caught on to the fact that anytime you say anything that Israel or its allies do not like, then that is what they'll use to kind of, whip you with. So, I mean, it doesn't hold any meaning anymore. And I think a lot of people really genuinely, I think other than a very small group of people who are not to be converted, these are the people who are already either being paid, have got some interest with the state of Israel. The rest of the world, really, some of them are vocal and will speak out. Others will not speak out, but they know and they believe that Israel is committing a genocide. And they do not believe or trust the mainstream media anymore. That is why I think if you look at the numbers of alternative media, the viewership that is picking up is a sign that the mainstream media is really collapsing, whether it's you're talking about the newspaper readership or you're talking of viewership. But people recognize that these are all lies. I mean, for a Sky, some I divine intervention for this reporter on Sky News to be able to get out a story that was actually true, that was telling the truth, and nobody was able to see it until later they had to revise it. This is divine intervention. And we know that, you know, you cannot hide the truth forever. You may lie to some people some of the time, but you cannot lie to all the people all the time. Indeed. And the lies have come to really, you know, everybody knows now what the truth is.
Right, right. Well, Mick, there's a growing schism, as we've been talking about, between the European people and their governments, especially on the issue of Gaza. For example, in a recent poll in Germany, nearly 80% of Germans say they oppose military support for Israel in Gaza, and yet the EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. I mean, where do you see this heading? I mean, this difference, this growing difference between what the people want and what their governments actually do.
Well, we have examples from the past of, for example, America invading Vietnam and a powerful international movement supporting resistance defeated the Pentagon, and America was massively humiliated and defeated, and its invasion was reversed. So I think everything depends upon the next year or so. But the terrible cost to the people of Gaza and Palestine, and now to the people of Lebanon, is so dear. It's tens of thousands of children murdered and adults and so on. But this is acid eating away at the status quo in these so-called Western semi-democracies, because it's impossible to cover up that Israel is a brutal genocidal agent. And even the World Court and even the UN General Assembly and even the International Union of Parliamentarians, we see Israel humiliated and isolated because around the world, so many more millions of people are becoming not just aware, but increasingly angry. And that makes our governments afraid. Our own Prime Minister here in Britain, Starmer, famously said that Israel had the right to deny water to the people of Gaza, i.e. has the right to kill them all. He cannot appear publicly in Britain anywhere, because if he did, there would be huge demonstrations. He's in the same position that Tony Blair was in after the invasion and devastation of Iraq. So public opinion is there, but how we channel this into action to really put fear into our rulers, that they've got a choice between abandoning Israel or sticking with Israel and paying a high price from their population, that's the calculus we have to work on going forward.
Okay. Well, Sakina, the resistance response to the regime is that the West Bank has been and will be an integral part of the Palestinian state, basically telling the regime that it will not allow it to annex the West Bank. Your thoughts on that, and where do you see this all going, especially with the resistance?
I think the resistance has shown the resilience, but also the ability that nobody really thought was possible. If we look at the example of Lebanon, I mean, now they have started on phase two, and we are questioning what was phase one, and if they have finished phase one, what have they achieved? They have achieved nothing. They haven't been able to claim even an inch of it. In Gaza and West Bank that you mentioned, they have only managed to kill scores of women and children, and even those who die, and of course, there is no, when people die in the manner that they die, that is sad, but also that is not a victory, because for those who died, for them this is martyrdom, and they cherish martyrdom. So in real sense, the resistance has been very effective. Now whether anyone else likes them or not, they have been able to hold back Israel, and Israel has got absolutely nothing to show for victory. They were started out October 7th or 8th in order to get their own hostages back. They haven't been able to do that. So I think, there is no other way. People talk about diplomacy, about, sitting down and discussing ceasefire. We have seen that none of these really works. Everything has failed. There is no way that, Palestine, Gaza, Lebanon can be defended other than by the resistance. Okay. And this is a fact.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us here on the Spotlight. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. Sakina Datto, journalist and writer out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarsi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we are discussing the 62nd verse of this chapter. Now let's listen to this verse.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ وَيَجْعَلُكُمْ خُلَفَاءَ الْأَرْضِ أَإِلَهٌ مَّعَ اللَّهِ قَلِيلًا مَّا تَذَكَّرُونَ
Is he not best who responds to the desperate one when he calls upon him? And removes evil and makes you inheritors of the earth? Is there a deity with Allah? Little do you remember.
So, brothers and sisters, in the previous episodes, we entered the long discussion of dua, supplication, and the relationship between supplication and its acceptance. Because the verse we are discussing says, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءُ Or the one who answers the call of the distressed and actually removes the distress from him. So, regarding this, we said that there is this concept of dua, which is from the supplicant. أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ When he calls on him. And there is this concept of ijabah, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ The one who answers, the one who accepts. Now, we said that we cannot fully discuss the concept of relation between the two without taking into our consideration the aspect of obstacles. We said that there are some obstacles that we are not aware of, they are not mentioned explicitly in the specific verses that discuss concept of supplication and dua in the Holy Quran, but we see it scattered throughout the different traditions. Our traditions and narrations, in them we see plethora of examples of different conditions, requisites, prerequisites for the acceptance of dua. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, for example, is narrated to have said that at some times a servant makes a petition and Allah, the Blessed, the Exalted, says, grant his need quickly because I hate his voice. But some other times, it is narrated to have said, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that a servant makes supplication and Allah, the Almighty, the Majestic, says, I have indeed answered him, but I need him confined to his need because I love listening to his voice. So, even if the acceptance of prayer is detrimental for the supplicant, Allah the Exalted does not absolutely annul the response to the prayer. This is the most important thing. He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his mercy, transforms this supplication to be a kind of kafara of his sins, and makes actually this a means of forgiveness, or the Almighty Allah converts it to a provision for him in this world, and grants him instead lofty stations in the heaven. So, this is the most important thing. There are sometimes some obstacles that we might not consider in the very first place, but they are actually affecting the acceptance of dua.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
So, brothers and sisters, regarding this verse of the Holy Quran, this verse, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءِ, in this chapter, we said that there are sometimes there are some delays, some substitutions in the acceptance of a prayer, that the servant might actually mistakenly see them as the signs of rejection. But the Holy Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, no Muslim calls on Allah the Glorious, provided that his prayer has not been made for severing the ties of kinship or committing a sin, except that Allah shall grant him one of the three things. Either he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, will quickly grant his prayer, or he will delay it, or he will avert calamity from him of its like. Why? Because we read that it is said, O Messenger of Allah, we will increase in praying in this case, said his companions. He, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, replied, indeed, do increase. So, this is what the companions of the Prophet were told by him. He, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, is also reported to have said that prayer and dua is the essence of worship. And dear listeners, this is what we have thoroughly discussed in the previous episodes. There is no believer who prays to Allah, but that he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, responds to him. Either he quickly grants it to him in this world, or delays it to the hereafter, or forgives from him some of his sins to the extent that he has prayed to him. So long as he does not pray for a sin. And we also see that through the tradition of the Ahlul Bayt, how through their conduct and their lifestyle, their lifestyle is replete with these kinds of things. In his will to son Al-Hasan, according to the narration of Sharif, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, thus, delay in his response should not disappoint you, because that which is granted is according to the intention of the supplicant. Some of the time, Imam Ali says to his son, some of the time, response might be delayed so that it may greatly increase in the reward of the supplicant and cause ample bounties for the hopeful in Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart, lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Banking system connected to Russia's Mir payment network, signaling a new chapter in Tehran-Moscow relations. The announcement made in a ceremony held in the Iranian capital Tehran, attended by the governor of Iran's central bank and the ambassador to Russia. All in line with a common objective, boosting bilateral ties.
As a valuable neighbor, Russia offers great potential for strong transactions, particularly with our shared perspectives on regional and international events. This positive step can foster increased trade and transactions, and aligns with our goal to use national currencies and pursue de-dollarization, in line with other BRICS members.
According to the officials in charge, the project consists of three phases. The first phase enables Iranian citizens to use their bank cards to withdraw cash from Russian ATMs in rubles. In the second phase, Russian citizens will be able to do the same in Iran. And in the third phase, Russian stores will be linked to Iranian POS terminals, while ATMs in Russia equipped with NFC technology will accept bank cards from Iran's Shetab network. As Iran and Russia forge stronger financial ties, their connected banking systems pave the way for smoother trade and transactions, with ongoing negotiations for an alternative payments messaging service aimed to serve as a replacement for the SWIFT banking system. This comes after the agreement to link Russia's Mir payment network to Iran's Shetab banking system was finalized in St. Petersburg in July.
3 years ago, we introduced the notion of integrating Iran's card payment networks with those of other nations, circumventing Western-imposed sanctions. We are delighted that Russia has joined us in this endeavor, as a project initially projected to span a decade was accomplished in a mere year and a half.
Russia launched the Mir payment system in 2017 as an alternative to international financial services such as Visa and MasterCard. Farzan Ashurian, Tehran.
These
These are the local Shia tribesmen from Pakistan's Kurram tribal region protesting against the closure of a key route connecting them with the rest of the country. It has been more than a month since this essential passage was blocked, isolating the Kurram tribal region with Palachinar at its heart. This has triggered a severe humanitarian crisis in the area near the border with Afghanistan. The closure of this essential passage following recent attacks by pro-Takfiri militant groups that had left over 50 Shia Muslims dead has isolated the district, leading to severe shortages of vital medical supplies and essential commodities, halted educational activities, and severely disrupted daily life.
We are in bad situation because the line order situation here has happened more than 2 weeks. The road is closed. The medicine shortage is on a first stage. I kindly request the government institution, please involve in this situation, give a solution, especially for medicine, because the health is more important than everything. The first thing is health.
Hamara Parichinar ka road bilkul band hai.
The road closures and militant attacks have made life unbearable for us. My small shop, which once thrived by selling daily essentials, now stands half empty. Supplies haven't arrived for weeks, and prices for whatever little is available have shot up.
The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan has expressed serious concerns over the humanitarian crisis in Parachinar, urging the government to take immediate action to alleviate the suffering of residents.
The government of Pakistan, along with provincial authorities, must urgently reopen the roads to recover from the humanitarian situation in the region and deploy all available resources to prevent cross-border militant attacks from neighboring Afghanistan to maintain peace in Parachinar.
While assuring that the key route will be reopened soon, authorities have stated that the closure was necessary to prevent militant attacks as the violence was escalating into an ethnic and sectarian conflict.
Parachinar's history is marked by the infiltration of militants that have launched assaults on local Shia communities, resulting in widespread bloodshed. These conflicts have often led to road closures, isolating residents and intensifying their hardships. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Yet another Sunday in Sydney, and once again, crowds fill the streets in a powerful display of solidarity with the people of Palestine and Lebanon. Chants echo through the hearts of the city as demonstrators march, their voices united in support for Palestinian rights. At the gathering, a Palestinian speaker took a moment to thank the Australian people for their relentless support, urging them to keep pushing the movement for justice forward.
Prepare to fight.
They say that terrorists can't occupy the mind of people, the heart of a people that have dignity and honor and are willing to die for it.
And we're tired.
Among the demonstrators are Michael Payne and his sister, a dedicated pair who have been unwavering in their advocacy. As staunch supporters of humanitarian rights, the siblings have rarely missed a Sunday without standing up for the Palestinian cause. The crimes must stop, they say, calling on others to join their fight for a just and humane world.
They're claiming that the criminal has a right to defend itself. Well, that's not correct. The criminal has a right to a defence lawyer. They might have a right to a fair trial or something like that, but they don't have the right to defend themselves against the people they're targeting with their horrendous, heinous crimes. So to me, that's part of the spokespeople from the Western governments that claim this.
It seems very bizarre. We have all these international humanitarian laws, international laws about a nation being able to defend themselves from invasion, and yet what Israel has done is completely invade. They have kept the whole of Gaza prisoner. 2.3 million people are prisoner.
Protesters from all walks of life have come together, highlighting the universal call for justice. University students in Sydney have been a notable presence, voicing their commitment to human rights and standing in unity with the Palestinian people. For them, this isn't just a moment. It's a movement that demands global attention.
I think the narrative has definitely changed. I mean, Israel has been enacting a kind of slow creeping genocide for decades and decades. Now it's like accelerated 100 times with what's happening in Gaza. I think definitely it's a genocide, it's ethnic cleansing.
Despite mounting pressure and opposition, pro-Palestine groups in Australia continue to make their voices heard, fighting for their fundamental right to protest. Amid government criticism, these activists hold firm, asserting that the call for freedom and justice cannot be silenced. They emphasize that nations like Australia cannot remain silent. They must take action and hold Israel accountable, rejecting any stance of complicity in the face of injustice. For people here, this protest isn't just an event. It has turned into a movement for justice, a stand to secure a future rooted in what's right. Shahana Butt, Sydney.
In a heartfelt show of solidarity, Pakistanis have gathered in Islamabad to mark 40 days since the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, the influential Hezbollah leader who was killed by Israeli forces in Lebanon last month. The memorial ceremony drew people from all walks of life, united in honoring Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah's legacy of resistance and condemning the actions of the U.S. and Israel in Gaza.
The silence of those who seek to appease their Western masters, including the U.S. and U.K., has been glaringly exposed during Israel's unrelenting genocide in Gaza. The world will never forget the oppression inflicted by Israel and the United States on the Palestinians, and sooner or later, both will be brought to justice.
The event, held at the heart of the city, served as a reminder of Hassan Nasrullah's influence that transcended borders, resonating deeply with people far beyond Lebanon.
Shahid Hassan Nasrullah.
Nasrullah's life was defined by his commitment to resistance and his people. He was more than just a leader. He was a symbol of defiance against oppression and a beacon for those striving for dignity and justice.
Participants also spoke about the ongoing humanitarian crisis faced by the Palestinians, particularly in Gaza.
The events in Gaza signal that Israel's reckoning is near. The resilience of the people of Gaza and Lebanon proves their promise, choosing death over surrender to an oppressive Zionist entity. The destruction and loss of life do not signify victory for Israel, but mark a defeat for both Israel and the U.S.
The venue was adorned with large framed photographs of martyrs from Gaza and portraits of resistance leaders who had sacrificed their lives fighting against Israeli atrocities. Replicas of children's bodies shrouded in white cloth lay as silent witnesses to the human cost of war and Israeli oppression in Gaza.
The memorial not only honored Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah and other resistance martyrs, but also served as a powerful testament to the shared resilience of those fighting for a future free from violence and oppression. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Khan Yunis refugee camp area is subjected to several Israeli military operations, including ground incursions and continuing airstrikes in this area that literally turned the homes and the building, along with the people inside them, into rubble. These military operations forced thousands of families to flee the area for months now. But after the Israeli troops withdrew from this area, families are still returning to this area, insisting that they are the owners of this land despite the painful losses they were subjected to.
Of course, we return to this area where our parents and grandparents lived. We will continue to live despite the tough conditions and the lack of almost every necessity of life. The occupation wants us out of here, but this is where we will remain despite all the hardships.
After Israel has created an uninhabitable reality for Gazans, they are still determined and persist to return to the ruins of their homes and dig with their own bare hands, trying to extract fractions of their lost memories there.
We are looking for some clothes under the ruins of our home. We have nothing. The occupation destroyed our home, and all of our belongings have been buried here. but we will never lose hope of rebuilding our home again.
After 400 days of an inhumane aggression that buried the homes of Gazans along with their loved ones and still seems like an endless nightmare to them, the Gazans have returned to their destroyed areas and stayed there to continue to affirm on one fact: they are the rightful owners of this land. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
The moment Iranians were waiting for. Signals received from the satellites Hudhud and Kosar. A successful communication indicating that both satellites are operational and ready to fulfill their missions, marking a significant milestone in Iran's space program. This significant achievement is in line with Iran's long-term space plans.
One of the key priorities for us in the 14th administration is to accelerate the development of the space industry by involving the private sector and leveraging its capabilities. The space industry holds significant potential, and we have the resources of universities and homegrown knowledge.
The launch on November 5th using a Russian Soyuz satellite launcher successfully placed Hudhud and Kosar into orbit. The Kosar satellite with a remote sensing device is intended for agriculture, natural resource management, and environmental monitoring. And the Hudhud satellite is designed to support Internet of Things. At the Secretariat of the Supreme Space Council, I realize that this is just the beginning of Iran's ambitious journey into space exploration.
We anticipate 5 to 7 more launches by March. Our indigenous technology allows us to both launch and produce satellites domestically. However, we will also be using foreign launchers, as we did in Russia. Currently, we're in the research and development phase. And in order to conduct in-orbit tests on the satellites, we need more launches.
Iran's space program aims to drive economic growth. With an average growth rate of 9% per annum in the global space economy, Iran is positioning itself to capitalize on this rapidly expanding market, projected to reach $1.8 trillion by 2035.
Iran's space program highlights its growing expertise and ambition in this field. The advancements showcase Iran's commitment to becoming a key player in regional and international aerospace development. Gisum Shahmari, Tehran.
The Jordanian people continue to protest against the wars in Gaza and Lebanon, calling on Arab nations to unite in pressuring Israel into ending the ongoing genocide and daily massacres. The march organized by Jordan's Islamic Movement urged immediate action to lift the blockade on Gaza.
400 days of siege, hunger and war, depriving our people in Gaza of medicine, food and water. Today we call on the Arab world, the international community and all people to rise up, to stop this war of extermination and to make their voices heard. Without forgetting that this entity's greed knows no bounds,
participants warned of the regime's efforts to displace the residents of Gaza and the occupied West Bank as part of an expansionist project targeting Arab nations. They urged Arab countries to act decisively to halt these plans and called on the Jordanian government to sever all ties with the regime, including cancelling the Wadi Araba Treaty and agreements on gas and water.
This message is directed at the Arab and Islamic world and the international community. It is imperative to stop the violations and mass extermination in Gaza and Lebanon. We stand in solidarity with the resistance in Gaza and Lebanon, recognizing the profound sacrifices made by the Palestinian and Lebanese people.
The Zionist forces continue their massacres to achieve their objectives, aiming to eliminate the resistance in Palestine and extend their violations throughout the region. Their intent is not only to impose their will on the Palestinian resistance, but on the entire world. They reject resolutions and defy international consensus, while the resistance remains the only force standing in their way.
Protesters expressed solidarity with the resistance in Gaza and southern Lebanon, standing strong against the brutal aggression, while condemning the silence of the international community and the Arab world in the face of ongoing massacres and the targeting of civilians.
The march was joined by political parties, national and Islamic figures, and the National Forum for Supporting the Resistance.
Participants in today's march call on Arab nations to take a right stance, holding them accountable for Gaza's blockade and urging immediate action to end the Israeli genocide. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, love of the world. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Sister Zainab speaking to you on A to Z about love of the world. So love of the world is something that to some extent affects all of us. And what we're talking about is the idea that, so what is love of the world? Love of the world is loving or being totally enraptured with material things, with the worldly life. So we're not talking about just enjoying things and using things that we're given in this life. So what we know as Muslims is that Allah gives everything to us. Allah gives us many blessings. If we're very blessed, we have good health, we have children, we have family, we have siblings, we have a reasonable lifestyle, maybe we have a job that pays the bills, we have access to good food. So these are all worldly things. Maybe we have a nice house, maybe we have a car, maybe we can afford to go on holiday. All these things are blessings, so Allah gives all of these to us. But what we're saying in Islam is that, it's okay to have these things and to enjoy them, of course, and we should remember to actually to be grateful to the being that is the source of all of this, because we're not supposed to be grateful for, wherever obviously our employer pays us the money, but ultimately the source of all blessings, of everything good, of all the material benefits is Allah. So that's all good. Now, what we mean by love of the world in this context is that we should not become too attached to things, because this is also what Allah says to us. Allah wants us to, in a sense, develop a detachment from the world, because if we become too attached to things, you can imagine, if we're just thinking about our new house, our new car, let's take the new house, we're maybe just thinking about, what furniture do I need to get? And we're just walking past all the furniture stores, and our whole mind is preoccupied with this thing of making our house even more luxurious, more beautiful. So you can imagine in our mind, there's no space for much remembrance of Allah. So obviously this is what we need to stop. We need to literally, if that is the case with us, we need to try and identify that and stop doing that. And I just remind you of some hadith in this context. So you've probably heard that our imams say that, for example, this world is just the nursery for the training of lofty souls. So whatever happens in this world, wherever we're given any opportunities for good deeds, we have any opportunities for good words. This is how we train ourselves, how we perfect our soul, so that when it comes to the end of our life, we, in a sense, we've sent ahead to the hereafter as many good deeds, as many good words as we can. And Imam Ja'far Sadiq, for example, said that the love of the world is the source of all transgressions. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio, and I'm talking a little bit about love of the world. So I'll bring you a very nice hadith from Imam Ali. Imam Ali has said that this world is the abode of truth for him who appreciates its truthfulness, a place of safety for him who understands it, a mine of treasures for him who understands it, and a house of instructions for him who draws lessons from it. So this is the purpose of this world. This world is, in a sense, a small, unimportant, temporary place. And the hereafter, the place we go to after this, is what really matters. But that doesn't mean that we disregard this and say, well, why are we here? No, we're here for a purpose. It's in this world that, in a sense, we gather these things, our provisions for the hereafter. And obviously, our love of the world, we're thinking about those of us, maybe many of us, majority of us, I don't know, who just become attached to stuff. And in these present days, you've probably become aware that there are people out there who are, for example, donating all their gold jewelry to raise funds for people in Lebanon. So this is